and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Our weekly conversations always include you. If you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open. 941-3689 if you call us from Oahu, and from the neighbor islands, toll free, 877-941-3689. Well, over a decade ago, we had our first Town Square discussion about caregiving in Hawaii. In the time since, there has been a steady stream of information to get across this message. There's a good chance you or someone you love will need a caregiver. With the great longevity of Hawaii residents, it's no wonder we have more multi-generational households than other states. Yet how to find help to care for our elders remains an overwhelming task for many families. Tonight on Town Square, we look at caregiving in Hawaii, private care, care homes, and what you can and can't expect from the state. If you are on the front lines of caregiving as a family member, private caregiver, or if you're care home-based, we want to hear from you, too. What's the one thing you think the rest of us should better understand about caregiving? And if you have a question about how to navigate to the best solution for you and your family, our phone lines are open for you, too. Again, those numbers, 941-3689 from Oahu, and from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. Tonight, our panel includes Gary Powell. He is the founder and executive director of the Caregiving Foundation. He became a caregiver to his grandfather when he was only a teenager. In an effort to formalize his longtime work in assisting and supporting and educating seniors and their families on caregiving, he established the foundation on Oahu in 2008. The organization now assists over 120 fee-for-service clients on this island, Kauai, Maui, Molokai, and the Big Island. Carla Kroll joins us. She's a private pay caregiver. She's worked extensively in senior care since the early 1990s. She gets her referrals from geriatric care managers, RN case managers, and social workers. She also works directly with families to care and advocate for their elders. She's been a member of the Hawaii Pacific Gerontological Society since 2001. And rounding out our panel is Ramon Samupkai. He's a registered nurse and retired from the Army after 20 years of service. He and his wife operate an adult residential care home, one they've had for the last 9 years. He's also an officer of the Alliance of Residential Care Administrators, an association of about 170 care home operators. He's an advocacy volunteer for AARP and president-elect of the Philippine Nurses Association of America, Hawaii chapter. That's our panel. It also includes you. Again, our numbers are 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And welcome to all of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Beth, for having us here.
A pleasure. And hopefully we can make it somewhat more pleasurable for a lot of families who may or may not realize that they're going to be facing some caregiving issues in the not-too-distant future. When people say caregiving, sometimes people's eyes will just glaze over because it can be utterly overwhelming for any of us who have been through it to say, yeah, this is one of the toughest things that we've ever had to do. But because there's so much confusion about what caregiving is, you know, is it something that's in the home? Is it a group home? Is it in what's a care home? I want to go around the table and just get some clarity about what are the things that we are talking about when we look at caregiving. Ramon, I'm going to start with you since you have a care home.
I would say, generally speaking, when you say caregiving, it could be categorized in two categories, like a family caregiving or the home care caregiving, like you're providing care to adults or seniors not related to you. So mostly that's the two categories of caregiving. And regardless of what category you're talking about, caregiving itself is a very, very stressful job. I'm a nurse, and I used to work at a hospital, and just taking care of patients, really, it's a highly stressful job. So it can really affect your entire life if you don't know how to handle stress at all. So,
and we'll get to that a little later, too. But when you look at the confusion that some people have when you say here care home as opposed to a foster home, what are the differences?
Well, that's true. It's really confusing. Just like the report of this long-term care reform in Hawaii, it says that the long-term care is a system, is a complex system, and is broken because of that complexities. The foster homes are those created specifically for Medicaid beneficiaries. They are certified under the Department of Human Services. And the care homes are those licensed by the Department of Health. And it used to be the foster homes can only handle two skilled nursing level care clients, and then eventually they were allowed three, which with one private pay. And care homes are allowed five ambulatory type clients, and they can have two expanded, they call it expanded, which a skilled nursing level. So,
jump in here, Gary. Is it confusing when you have one part or one sector of caregiving being sort of overseen by Department of Health, and then you have Department of Human Services looking at is that confusing for a lot of people?
I think it's one of the main confusions that people have to face. The idea that Medicaid clients are beneficiaries of government programs and don't have out-of-pocket fees makes many people think that they have that kind of service is available for everyone. And yet Medicaid has very specific requirements in order to be able to benefit from it. People in general look at caregiving and care homes as one entity, one single thing. They don't break it up in their minds into categories of this kind of care home and that kind of care home, and they end up being totally confused over it. And naturally, as Ramon said, the stress level that accompanies that confusion can really be debilitating.
Carla, you are involved only with private pay clients.
Yes.
Somebody finds you and you become their caregiver if they like you and the situation works out
right.
Well.
Matches.
So you don't have to go through some of this other part when you have someone who is Medicaid eligible or any of it because it's not applicable.
Well, it's not applicable, and yet there have been circumstances where somebody is a Medicaid patient and they're in a care home and the family pays for me to go to the care home to take them out periodically, just to get them out of the care home, out about in the community, and have just a little bit of respite outside of the facility in which they're living as a Medicaid patient.
But that's sort of becoming a companion for the day.
Yes.
Or and go off and have an excursion, but not necessarily being responsible for that person's care all
the time. No, not that person's care when they're in the facility, right? In terms of private pay caregiving, I do that with people in their own homes and sometimes separate from the family. The family will designate me as the person to take care of things, and then I communicate with them. And other times I work in conjunction with families to do respite and assist with advocacy and other things that are within my knowledge and scope of practice.
Is that mostly with people who are living someplace else and they need to have a liaison here, and so you become that liaison as opposed to a family who is going to embrace their elders and keep them at home and need someone to come in and be with them for a set period of the day?
It's both. I communicate with sons and daughters, nieces and nephews in the mainland, as well as I also work with people who live here in town that are sandwich generation, that have their own grandchildren and their own children, and then they have their seniors, their mom, dad, auntie, uncle, whoever, that needs senior care.
Well, we already have callers on the line, and if you want to get into this conversation about caregiving in Hawaii, if you are a caregiver and you think that there's something about caregiving that we're just missing, we really want to hear from you. And if you've got a question about caregiving, if all of a sudden you found yourself faced with what are we going to do, now is a good time to ask a question. Our phone line is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you're on the Neighbor Islands. Going now to Jeannie. Aloha, Jeannie. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, Bethann. This is a very sensitive subject and very emotional, I was able to keep my husband at home for 9.5 years with caregivers, and I have to say that at the beginning it was completely overwhelming and so stressful. There are cultural differences to consider. Many caregivers, English is their second language. The caregivers that we had were, in most cases, wonderful, but they did not want to make decisions as to medications and doctor's appointments and things like that. So I really advocate for a family member that people really talk about ahead of time and say, if something happens, this person is going to be there for doctor's appointments, for medication information. And where one of the biggest problems that we had was when my husband would be discharged from a hospital, and I think we were practically at all the hospitals during the last 9.5 years. A discharge procedure that's very specific, I know, and you're probably not getting into it to that detail, but it really is confusing, and I think that is one of the reasons why there's so many readmissions. There's just, as people have said before, this is such a broad topic, and it touches so many families in Hawaii, and it's one that we really need to, and I thank you so much for bringing this out, and I'll stay on the line, and if I could be of any assistance, I would very much like to help where I can.
All right, Jeannie, thank you very much for calling. You know, she's advocating that there should be a point person, not exactly a designated driver for the rest of somebody's life and then who's going to be in charge of medicine and all that, but something on the line of someone who's going to be the go-to for all of that. She also brings up the point about the discharge from a hospital, and we've seen now for 2 years a bill fail that would have given training to families. Hospitals don't like it. They don't want to feel that they have to do that. But that's leading, as she says, to a lot of readmissions. That's been the reason why it was pushed in the first place. Let's talk a little bit about that as she's brought it up. How many times have you seen someone readmitted because families didn't know what to do, Carla or Gary, you too, because I know you talk to a lot of family caregivers?
Several times, because people, it's like the lady said, it's an emotional issue. And so when you're bringing your freshly discharged parent home, and they've been ill, they're still probably ill because the rate of staying in the hospital is being decreased because of the reimbursement issues, that then they don't have adequate, first of all, the discharge time is all of a sudden you find out maybe a few hours in advance, okay, we're discharging you now, which puts the discharge planners at a great disadvantage and the family to get together to be able to find a point person, Beth Ann, to say, okay, who's going to be the person in charge of getting this information and then disseminating it to the rest of us and coordinating all of the follow-up, doctor's appointments, rehab, et cetera.
All right, we've got other callers online, but just for one moment, I want to get you back into this, Gary, too, because you talk to so many families and caregivers. How much repeat do you see happening?
There's a tremendous amount. One of the most frequent calls we get at our offices is that call that someone has been discharged from the hospital tomorrow. What am I supposed to do? It comes in so frequently. Or the call that comes and says, you know, they sent my dad home after a fall, but we didn't know how to really position him, what to take, how to carry him, how to help him, and he fell down again. He's back in the hospital. What can we do now? It's really tragic that ever happens.
What do you think would make the difference in making that case to the hospitals? I mean, we've tried for 2 years. We've seen this play out, and it's failed again this year. Is there something that you think that hasn't been said or an interest in the hospital that hasn't been well highlighted?
I think there's a disconnect in the hospitals between the administration, the finance, and the discharge planners. The discharge planners that we work with really would like to have the time to make sure that families had everything set up. but they're under pressure to get this person out as quickly as possible.
This also affects you with care homes because sometimes you have to take someone into the hospital too, Ramon.
Yes, Beth, but I would like, may I take on the question because it's really, that's what I've been volunteering for AARP for the last 2 years as being an advocacy volunteer, and I go to the legislation during the session and provide support testimonies for this legislative initiative of AARP. AARP has been pushing this issue for the last 2 years, and you said it failed because I guess it's the disconnect between hospitals and advocacy groups for caregiving, and it's called CARE Act, but it's popularly known as CARE Act. Okay, it's what it does is it identifies a caregiver. Once a patient is admitted to the hospital, a caregiver has to be identified who is the caregiver, and then once the patient is ready to be discharged, that person has to be trained, has to be informed, all those
That's
things.
What the bill would have done.
Yes, yeah. Would have done. And at first, last year, the big issue was the liability issue, that the hospital systems raised the liability issue. So this year, they tried to water down the liability issue because New Jersey has passed the law, the bill, that it became law, and there's no liability issue. They took down that, and they tried that here. And still it didn't pass. So what happened, it ended up in a resolution. So now the resolution is HCR 107, which I was there last week at the hearing, and it calls for another working group. That this working group will work it out and see what they can come up with. Because the problem last year with the working group is the imbalance of the working group. It says hospitals have more of the numbers than the
people
advocates.
Who comprise yes. the working group were heavily weighted toward the hospitals.
Exactly. So now the Senate said, "Oh, you got to do it more balanced this time, so it's going to be fair." So hopefully, when the working group will do their job, will be convened, and they will deliberate for a year until the next session, and they will give a report to the Senate.
So. Beth Ann, this makes me think of what you just said. It's so important for a family to have someone designated who is that point person. It's great for the hospitals to be able to support that, hopefully someday, but families have to be very proactive in producing that person, whether it's a hired person or someone in the family, who can be there at discharge, have a plan, know where the person's going, know what they're going to need, and really be comprehensive in planning that care.
But that sole person focused on the needs of, the elder, if that can't be a family member and you have to bring someone in to do that, that becomes a very costly process for a lot of people too.
It can. Professional case managers or folks like Carla, they're not as expensive as you think, especially when you weigh the option of not having them in the confusion that can impact an entire family's functioning.
When you're trying to go to work or get mm-hmm. kids to school and do all the other things that you're trying to do and maintain a life, it can be a tough one. If you are involved with that now, we want to hear from you. 941-3689. Are you caring for elders in your family? What decisions have you made? What choices did you look at before you made your decision? 941-3689 is our number, or 877-941-3689. Going to Jess calling us from Makakilo. Aloha, Jess. Thanks for your patience. Jess,
hello?
Are you there? Hello, Jess, are you there?
Yes. We are lucky to have a panel of people in different roles of caregiving, and I was hoping that each one could share some of the common challenges that they face while they're doing their job.
Okay. All right. We can do that very quickly. What are some of the challenges that each of you faces when you're trying to do your job? And it's some of the same things that you all do, but sometimes it may be different because of the different circumstances, the care home versus in someone's own home. Ramon?
Oh, it could be anything. Could be challenges, like, it varies. But one of the things that I've experienced is sometimes the families would interfere with the treatment or what the doctor's orders. And it's a big challenge because now the doctor is telling you this is what your mom needs, and then the family says, no, especially if it's like a behavior issue. Then now the caregivers will deal with the behavior because the family doesn't want the medication. So that's a big challenge.
So like an example might be you've got someone who is very, very upset, having nightmares, mm-hmm. and the doctor says, I think they should be having XYZ medication.
XYZ.
And the family says, no, we're not going to do that.
We're not going to do that. So now you end up
sandwiched between the doctor and the family.
No, yeah, 24/7 up, just watching over this client. Could be screaming, could be running, wandering around the house, just about everything. So it's a very challenging. Just one client with that problem, your day is over. I mean, what about the other clients? What about the other activities that you got to do? So now you need one extra person just to keep an eye on that client. So it's challenging.
Gary?
Probably the biggest issue that I have to face is people who think the government is going to pay for the care and have not gotten real about the actual cost of care. So that's probably the biggest concern that we have to face every day, is trying to help people find out ways to afford care.
And then sort of help them through the sticker shock.
Yeah, very much.
Carla?
Primarily, it is a family issue, like Ramon was saying, where families have differences of opinion even among themselves. Some of them want the Tutu to have the medication, and others of them say, no, we don't want this person, we don't want anybody involved, it's just us, because it gets to be emotional and economic. A lot of those factors are at play. And then there is also the patient themselves, the client, where on a good day, they have their cognitive abilities. On a not-so-good day with diminished cognitive abilities, then reasoning with them is out of the question. And so that can be a big challenge and requires lots of attention and patience to just be with them and build the trust and have it be so that they feel safe, because that's the most important thing, is for the patient to feel, the client to feel safe.
And that might be more easily done if you have a one-to-one relationship. You're there just with your client, Carla. But when Ramon is saying he's got, you know,
right.
five people to look
Safety.
After and mm-hmm. trying to make sure it's fair to all, because you know, their families are also paying to have them there and well looked after, how do you do that? Sort of like having a child. Who gets what attention first? Who needs it most?
Well, you have to, just like in the hospital, the triage, you know, sort them out. Okay, so who needs attention, real immediate attention, you take care of that. Because otherwise, you don't want to disrupt the four, you know. So it's almost like in a nursing hospital that you have to deal with the most immediate thing. So if the client is screaming, sometimes I used to just drive around, put in the van and just go driving around. And usually it helps. It works. Just driving, put in the van, they would sleep. And the four or three are happy in the house. So when it's time to go back to the house and the client is awake, then back to...
start all over again?
It's all over again. So there's, challenges.
If you're just joining us tonight on Town Square, we're talking about caregiving with people who are on the front lines of caregiving. Maybe that's you too. We want to hear what your issues are and what you think we need to better focus on as we are all on these small islands together with a lot of people to be caring for and even more of them coming down the pike. 941-3689 is our number if you're on Oahu. And from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. Going to Mark, calling us from Hilo. Aloha, Mark. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha.
Hi there.
Can you hear me all right?
We can, yes.
Good. Okay. I'm calling mostly in relation to the negative effects that some of your panel have discussed about the failure to have the Caregivers Act passed. I was just talking to someone today who had worked on broken bones in her foot. And she said something about sometimes it gets so swollen. And I said, wasn't your caregiver given instructions about using ice? And she said, no. And I said, well, I'm not a doctor, but I've had bone surgery like that, and they always told me to use ice. And she said, okay, I'm going to ask my doctor. And then she was using crutches and having a lot of difficulty with that. And I said, well, have you talked to your doctor about using a walker or a cane? She really said, did you get any instructions about that? And she said, no. So I said, talk to your doctor about that. Now, fortunately, the swelling, I guess, never got too bad. She didn't fall. But if instructions were given, she wouldn't have this anxiety. The caregiver wouldn't have the anxiety. And it's very simple for a hospital to do. I think hospitals are worried that the Caregiver Act requires something like the caregiver sitting there for an hour or two where they have a class on how to take care of the patient. And if that actually were necessary, it should be done. I think in most cases, it probably would be instruction sheets, talking to the person, making sure they understand what to do. And the way I understand it, if a person comes back, and your panel, incidentally, has been great, they probably know the answer. If a person comes back within 30 days, Medicare especially is not happy about that, and I think hospitals can be penalized. Their rating goes down. If it's Medicaid, we, the taxpayers, then have to pay for the new Medicaid treatment. And we might have to for Medicare also. I'm not sure about that.
Mark, but you're bringing up the point that it seems to be very much in the interest of all to be able to get the caregiver well-trained so that that person can go home with a measure of confidence in being able to care for a loved one, or if it's a paid caregiver, to know that you have proper instructions. You know, interesting that when people come out of a hospital from having surgery and you get your discharge instructions and all of that, usually that happens, but he's making the point, as some of you on the panel have also said, that's not what happens when someone goes in and out who is with a caregiver, that the caregiver may not at all know what to do when they come out. Mark, thanks very much for the call. Going now to Carl, calling us from Hawaii Kai.
Hello, Beth Ann.
Hi there.
I'm glad you have this topic, and I just wanted to add to the conversation about the discharge planning. And actually, I have a kind of a positive story, but it kind of shows how this thing should work. My mother recently fell, and because she didn't really know why she fell, we took her to emergency, and they admitted her into the hospital because they wanted to observe her before they let her loose. And then, you know, she was there for 3 days, I think, and when they released her, they did let us know when her discharge was. Fortunately, I was able to be there. And in that discharge process, we had this long discussion because they thought maybe the medication she was taking, and, you know, my mother's in her late 90s, so, you know, she's one of these people, have a number of medications. We had a discussion about the medication she's taking, whether or not there was interaction, whether or not we should change it. And quite frankly, I think if I hadn't been there, they would have had a hard time having that conversation with my mom. So they did come up with a new regimen for her. They also told us what we needed to do to make sure it was followed. And when we got her home, we made sure we got the prescription set up and we made sure she followed it. And so far, she's been doing great. And I think that's what we're talking about, that it's important to have a designated caregiver who can not only be instructed but also participate in the conversation so the discharge treatment, I think, is a good one.
And generally speaking, Carl, are you the designated person in your family?
Fortunately, both my sister and I are able to help out.
So you both share.
In this particular instance, yeah, I was able to be at the hospital when she was there. Yeah.
Does that cause
any? They didn't know to call us. Yes.
Does that cause any strife between you and your sister? Do you,
no.
When you have to sit down and make decisions, that you make really good decisions
we
together?
To share it. You know, whoever is available is the person that would be participating.
So if you make a decision and later on she says to you, yeah, I'm not so sure that was the best decision, but she lives with it because you were the one who was on call at the moment to make the decision.
But then if we decide we needed to go talk again to a doctor to see whether or not that was correct, I think we would do that.
All right. Thanks so much for calling and sharing your experience. Glad to hear from you. Thanks, Carl.
Okay.
We've got other callers on the line. Promise we'll get to you in just a second. But when you heard Carl talk about how he acts with his sister and how they share this responsibility, is this typical or is it not so typical?
I would say it's quite rare.
It's ideal.
That's right.
Because I'm thinking they've got a very good relationship.
They're very fortunate.
Congratulations.
I've seen families who have really sorted out what is their responsibilities. Like one sibling is just taking care of finances. One sibling just taking care of some other needs of the mother. And some would be just making decisions. So it's it all depends on the family. I have one client. We have one client. The son lives here, and he is the POA supposedly. But the other sibling who is on the mainland and a lawyer and always like calling in, what's going on here, da-da-da-da, I should be there with, and calling the doctors, calling the hospitals, everything. So that's kind of disruptive to the process.
Well, and that's a problem for a lot of families where you've got one who thinks that they've got a plan happening and you've got another one who may come in for all the best intentions of the world because they care about the grandparent or the parent, and they make trouble.
Family dynamics can really be a hindrance to a good care.
Part of preparing for a family should be having a formal family meeting. Often it's best to have it facilitated by a case manager or someone who is well experienced in this area to develop a plan that the family can live with, not all agree on, but agree to deal with it.
Gary, how often does that happen?
Not very often, but more and more families are taking advantage of it and sitting down with our facilitators or somebody else and coming up with a plan that functions both from a financial aspect, a social aspect, trying to keep everybody's needs in focus while they come up with a good plan that will take care of mom or dad or whoever the care receiver is.
All right, we've got other callers on the line, people who want to talk to all of you. Going now to Dolores, calling us from Pearl City. And if you'd like to join us, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Aloha, Dolores. Welcome to Town Square.
Mahalo. Thank you. I called in reference to disabled retired veterans who are caring for their disabled family members, and they are excluded by the state from self-directive PCA compensation, which is governed by Medicaid. And I am advocating for change in this area. Some of the disabled veterans have had problems with the with law enforcement, or they've had trouble with accusations that were never resulting in any type of incarceration of any kind, and no disciplinary action was needed, but because it's stated on their Social Security records or state records from another state, they are labeled as criminals. And I have a problem with this because I ran into this problem with my husband, who is a disabled retired veteran, and I am terminally ill. He is my primary care giver, yet he has to basically take care and be burdened by my disabilities, and he has no compensation due him.
Dolores, you sounds like you have a lot on your plate. Gary, do you hear this story often about when you have one person in the couple who is perhaps disabled, another one who may be disabled veteran, that's her situation. Is this something that you see more often than not?
With her specific situation, no, where one of the parties has a, quote, criminal background that would prevent their participation in the compensation program. That I don't come across too often. I'm sorry that it is impacting this couple. But disabled vets taking care of someone who is disabled is very common. Just like everyone else, a family faces disabilities very often. And sometimes that family has existing disabilities. And that is a compound situation that is very difficult.
Because now you're not talking about one person. You're talking about two people who are both trying to take care of each other because they don't want to usually burden anybody else. You heard Dolores use the word burden. That seems to be a natural response. What happens in those situations where you actually need one caregiver who might be necessary for both?
Unfortunately, what usually happens is they get separated. Somebody has to go into a community foster home under the Medicaid program because that's the only care option left to them. And so the family unit is basically destroyed by government regulation.
And there's no way around that?
Not at present. If they don't have personal resources with which to take care of things, there really is no other solution.
And for someone who, as in Dolores' case, where she has a husband who, for whatever reason, now has a criminal background, is there any redress for her at all?
Well, there's always the appeal process. And the VA has, in the last few months, begun dealing with appeals in a more favorable manner. So I would sure go back to them and see if it's an issue that can be fought.
Well, Dolores, we wish you a lot of luck with that. Going now to Eric, calling us from Makakilo. Aloha, Eric.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Doing all right, thank you. How about you?
Excellent. Well, first I'd like to say that I am a paramedic, and I respond to calls a lot of times at these private care homes. What I'm asking about is mainly the care homes that people have converted. I'm sorry, homes that are converted into care home facilities where people actually live. For these caregivers, what are the regulations that they need to follow? Or what sort of educational process are they given as far as dealing with, say, do not resuscitate orders or living wills and power of attorney and power of medical decisions? Because we come across a lot of situations where they're uneducated or they don't know about it. And I'm not saying all of them, but there's a high percentage where there's a lot of confusion, and it actually is very detrimental in our treatment.
So, for example, you might show up to a house to be able to give care to someone who you've been called in to look after, and you ask a question of the person at the care home, and they don't know whether you should be resuscitating this person or not.
That's correct. You might say, yes, they do have a do not resuscitate, yet they don't produce the proper paperwork, or they say, so-and-so family member has power of attorney, but yet it doesn't necessarily mean power of medical decisions, and they're not sure of these semantics when it comes to logistics of the patient care. And I'm recording, is there an oversight committee? Is there a regulatory committee that is in charge of making sure that these care homes are continuously educated about this?
All right, well, let's ask Ramon. What happens in your care home when you have people who say, okay, this is what we want to have happen? They have a do not resuscitate.
There is, okay, if the power, living will, you know already, right? if you have a client who has a living will, it says do not resuscitate, or they have the pulse, it's called POLST, it's a document.
Physician orders.
Yeah. So you have that, and it tells you what the client wish, no resuscitation. So if you have the paper, then you are aware that something happens. The first thing when you call 911, it should be before the paramedics come in, you should be already making a
copy.
That's
a procedure. You're making a copy
of
it, you're handing it to them,
or
and saying,
we already
it is.
Have a copy of that ready just in case. In emergency, you should have rather ready. When you open the chart, you have a copy, boom. So when the paramedic comes in, this is the first thing they get asked. What is this? Do not resuscitate, or you have the pulse then.
So, but this is your procedure. But he's asking, is there a standard procedure that care homes are told to follow in situations like this?
I'm not sure if he says care home. Is that the foster home or the – I don't know what he means. Because for care homes, yes, it's a standard policy under the Department of Health. You should have that emergency, that papers ready. As a caregiver, you know, you should know that already.
Yeah. Many clients that I work with through geriatric care managers and nurse case managers make sure that as they do the intake of the patient, they work with the family on the advanced directives, the durable power of attorney, and under the circumstances, the physician-ordered life-sustaining treatment form, the PULSED, as Ramon was referring to it, that is in the case of an incapacitated, let's say a person with severe dementia, that is filled out by a significant person in the family. Sometimes even the geriatric care manager would be a witness to that and taking responsibility so that then those things are all in order in advance. And that's another level of education for families in terms of being prepared, because I think the question comes to, if not now, when?
Yeah, nothing knocks on your door and says, oh, by the way, your loved one is going to have an episode tonight. You better get that stuff ready.
Right. Yeah. And going to the doctor, the physician's offices kind of cursorily say, do you have these things? And it says, even on IDs and driver's license, do you have these things? But it's really being able to have them in hand or with your direct physician or clinic, as well as Ramon, like Kez and Gary probably too, in their charts.
All right, we're going to move on. Thanks very much, Eric, for the good call. We appreciate it. Going now to Lita calling us from Mililani. Aloha, welcome, and thanks for your patience.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I was a caregiver for my mom, who passed away this past December, and I just wanted to give some input. She fell in February of 2009, and she broke 3 vertebrae. She had already had dementia, and it developed into Alzheimer's. And I just wanted to say that for anyone out there, it's a lonely experience. Joyous experience. It's a depressing experience. And I attended caregivers meetings at Waiawa Hospital, Central Oahu Caregivers Meetings, and that helped a lot. Just talking to someone and sharing what you're going through is really helpful. It can get really lonely. And in the beginning, you know, visitors come, family comes, and then they just stop. And we cared for my mom at home for almost of the 6 years. At one time, she was at a facility for a couple months while Kaiser said they would pay for it. So we, you know, had some respite there. And after she fell, St. Francis Hospice came in, and you know, we thought we were going to lose her back in 2009. She lasted almost 6 years. And without the help of hospice, the angels from hospice, over the years, I don't know how we would have done it. She was on and off hospice for almost 6 years. She would graduate, you know, and then go back on Kaiser, and then, you know, something would happen, and then she'd go back on hospice.
So the point being that, you know, nothing is a direct line. There's no sort of continuum where you go from point A to B. It can go back and forth and back many, many times. But it really seems that you're also advising people to reach out, not to feel that you have to deal with this on your own and that you really shouldn't be dealing with this on your own, that you need to get the help.
Yes, that is my point. And I read a lot, and so that's how I found out about the caregivers meetings, which would happen once a month. And I wouldn't always be able to attend, but when I could, I would. And there's such a wonderful community of support, you know, and where we would have sometimes guest speakers, and after that, go around the table and share and talk, you know.
And that can be very helpful when you're listening to other people dealing with something similar to your situation, or even maybe very dissimilar, but just to know that people are out there having to cope with some very, very intense family issues.
Exactly. When it comes and to a lot of times a lot worse than you, you know.
It helps to put it in perspective, doesn't it? Thanks so much for calling us, Lita. We appreciate it. Going on now to Jermaine, calling us from Kaimuki. Aloha, Jermaine.
Aloha. I'm a caregiver to my 88-year-old mother who had hip surgery. And prior to discharge from the hospital and rehab, we were very fortunate enough that the physical therapist and the occupational therapist did train my family. But our biggest challenge was that we could not afford private paid services. So when she was discharged to go home, we had no choice. They had first mentioned a foster home, but we couldn't afford it, and neither could she. So we all had to, well, I have four sons and my husband. We all had to take shifts and help her full-time on a 24/7 basis. Luckily, we also had some assistance from Project Donna, which is a volunteer caregiver support program. And I really thank them for their help. However, going back to the CARE Act, when my father was discharged from the hospital for the last time to go home, we were told that we had to irrigate his stent for his kidney, and we had no instructions on how to do that. So it was very difficult at that time, and my mother was very clueless at that time, but I guess figured it out after a while, and again, with the help of Project Donna, we got assistance. So I'm very grateful to Project Donna.
Well, thank you very much for calling and, again, talking about another resource that's out there in the community. Actually, we've talked to the people at Project Donna in other conversations about caregiving that we've had over these last 15, 16 years. But it's always good to be reminded of what's out there. If you all around the table here could just say there are certain places to go to be able to get some really good information. If you had to name one place that you would suggest people start to look to get their arms around this a little bit, to be able to get some fluency with what may or may not be available from the state privately, some help from organizations that try to help people, even with respite, what would you advise people to do, Ramon?
Well, it depends where the client, the person is. If the person or the patient is the hospital, then they should have already start talking to the social worker. The social worker is your best point of contact. That person can navigate you through what is, that's their job. If the caller didn't have a chance to talk to a social worker, maybe there's something wrong. Because that should be part of the discharge planning. They should have, like, usually a week prior to discharge, that's not the ideal, or a few days, they start talking about, hey, what are we going to do with discharge with this patient? So what are the needs? They start identifying the needs. What about placement? What about this? What about that? So in the process, yes, there is a process that's supposed to be working. But then, just like we heard from the callers, there's some disconnect. They're not getting the necessary instructions. So
if it's hospital-based, you said obviously go to the social worker. But if it's not hospital-based and you're realizing, you know, when you come to that point and you think, we need help, I don't know where to go, what would be a first call? What would you say should
I would try to find the first caregiver support group meeting closest to them. For instance, we have one tonight at the Ko'olau Golf Course. We have meetings all over the island, and there are many different organizations that have caregiver support groups.
So do what Lita said. Reach out to somebody. Just say, how are you doing it?
Yes.
Tell me something about this. Help me get myself into this flow.
Most of the groups have a social worker or some expert that is a facilitator. And so you can access that information and that individual on an informal basis and get a lot of information and a lot of guidance.
And organizations like the Alzheimer's Association also have support groups that can facilitate understanding and communication and resource availability.
But what I hear all of you saying is that you've really got to be proactive about this and go out and go find people, go really find other resources and other people, organizations. It's not necessarily going to come to you. Even if you're in a hospital situation, you're still going to have to advocate, and you're really going to have to advance your own case with your loved one.
A lot of times also, I recommend people to call 211. 211 is the community resource. It's kind of like the 411 for community resources.
All right. Let's take a few more callers before we have to say goodbye for the evening. Let's talk to Rory calling us from Manoa. Aloha, Rory. Thanks for your patience.
Hi. Yes. Aloha. I'm calling because I wanted to let you know a resource. First, I'll tell you my background quick. I work at a care home here in Manoa called Manoa Cottage. We also have a skilled nursing facility called Manoa Cottage Tamaki. But I come from a technology background. And in the past few years, in working in this industry, I've seen how disconnected it is. One problem that we see so often is discharge planners calling our facility, looking for placement for something for someone, not knowing if we have a vacancy or not. Often, we don't have a vacancy. They have to hang up the phone, call the next place, see if they can find a vacancy that's a match. And often, there's kind of a punch list of factors that need to be narrowed down before you can figure out if someone is a match or not. So, I actually have been developing this website called careporters.com. And it's a search engine where care homes, foster homes, nursing homes can all go to the site and post their vacancies. And then you can search based on various criteria, whether it's private pay or Medicaid, or in the care home world, we have a level of care called expanded. And often that tends to be a limiting factor as to whether someone can come to our care home or not.
So just for most people who may not know what expanded care is, can you briefly say exactly what that would be?
Yeah, it's a higher level of care for a care home, and the regs state it as care that you would receive in an intermediate or skilled nursing facility.
So ostensibly skilled nursing care?
Yes. Although I think typically it tends to fall more in the ICF range. Intermediate care.
All right. Well, good luck with the website and for those people who will be able to look at it and also those who provide care. It sounds a lot like this becomes a do-it-yourself project, not only for the family seeking care, but also those who provide it to be able to make the match. There's that intermediary that seems to be missing. People have parts of the puzzle, but not the whole thing. Are we at all close, panel, to having someplace which is sort of a one-stop shop for people who are trying to find care and for care homes and foster homes and all the other parts of caregiving where they can find each other?
Last year, AARP worked very, very hard to have the ADRC, the bill to be passed. It's called the Aging Disability Resource Center. And it's supposed to be a one-stop shop for anyone looking for placement for a loved one. So hopefully that would be a big resource. And the missing piece of that, I think one part of that is people need to be educated that there is a resource center like ADRC.
But that comes actually after it's been funded and established. And right now it's sort of hanging in the balance.
Yes, yes.
So. All right, we're going to take one more caller. Kathleen calling us from Maui. Aloha, Kathleen. Welcome to Town Square.
Thank you very much. I'm calling regarding the CARE Act. But before I even say anything on that, I'd like to tell you that on Maui, we do have an ADRC center. The Office on Aging here on Maui is active and working in that area. So we're the first county that got the that thing going. So if anyone on Maui is listening, I highly recommend them to call the Office on Aging to get started, because my husband is on oxygen 24/7, and I have a daughter who had a massive stroke. And so they've been really helpful for me. But getting back to the CARE Act, I really, really believe in it. I think it's necessary. My husband had sepsis 9 times in and out of the hospital. And when he was on Oahu, they put a PICC line in his arm, and we were sent home. And I had to administer the medication through the PICC line and the cleaning twice a day, 3 o'clock in the morning. And I'm not a nursing person, and that's so out of my forte. It was nerve-wracking. They showed it to me one time, and I couldn't sleep. I was a nervous wreck. I have fibromyalgia and 3 herniated discs. And to put the thing into that arm, you have to sterilize it, and you can't go faster than 5 minutes. If you go too fast, you could kill them. I was terrified. And to have that stress put on an individual or a caring wife, it is really too much to ask. And when he was readmitted into the hospital, I was told by a nurse that on the mainland, only specialized nurses do that. So there's a lot of things that happen coming out of the hospital, and I had my husband discharged from Maui to another care facility, and we were discharged on a Saturday. Got there, they told me he needed oxygen, and they told me, go buy your own oxygen.
Kathleen, forgive me for interrupting you, but we've got a lot of noise coming from the back part of your line, but I think we've got what she's saying, that she too was not given enough information, was told that what she was being asked to do and only shown once is something that this very skilled nurse does on the mainland. People just not feeling adequately prepared to be able to do some of these things. And she said, if you do it too fast, you could kill them. What kind of stress and anxiety? And we know that very often caregivers sometimes will drop before the people they're giving care to. So we only have a couple minutes, panel, and obviously this is such a huge conversation, but to be able to just approximate some of it, where you see Hawaii is right now and some of the issues you think that are facing us as we are in spring of 2015 that maybe you didn't see before, that people should really pay attention to, and we'll start with you, Carla.
Patient education is paramount in terms of not only for the patient if they're capable themselves, but also in terms of their advocates, be they a caregiver, family member, whomever. Geriatric care managers and nurse case managers from the outside can also be very helpful.
Ramon?
Oh, yes. Thank you for having us here. The very good discussion. And just to next time around when AARP would introduce the bill about the CARE Act, please, we want more support, so it would be...
Okay, I know you're advocating here, but really for people, before that happens, is there one thing very quickly that you'd have them do besides get educated and really pay attention to the needs of their loved ones?
They have to also be proactive
All right, and I'll give you the last word, Gary.
Prepare. Don't wait until something happens. Think about it now. Plan now. Get it written down and really prepare.
And take it to heart. Gary Powell, thank you so much for coming. He's the director of the Caregiver Foundation. Carla Carl was with us too, private pay caregiver. And Ramon Sumibkai is here. He is an officer from the Alliance of Residential Care Administrators and a care home operator. Thanks to you for all your calls. I will see you tomorrow morning for the conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Have a good evening. Aloha.